Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in the Standard, 4-star review in the Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the ballroom of the Assembly Rooms. Please welcome a man who's on holiday in 1 hour's time. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello. Hello. It's lovely to be here. Thank you very much for coming along. Welcome to Richard Herring's last Scotch transmission podcast. For now, could be forever, couldn't it? Who knows? Could be the last one ever. Could be. Could be my last ever appearance at the Edinburgh Fringe. I nearly died last year. I could die. Also, you know, it's a poor lake being here, isn't it? Literally. Although I was talking to the fantastic crew here at the Ballroom Assembly Rooms, especially Reese, Jabs, Ruby, Joe, Tazzy and Aoife, who sound like they're members of Blazing Squad. They could be the members of Blazing Squad. They call it Rahulastapa. And let's give them all a fantastic round of applause for their fantastic work over the last couple of weeks. I have got them a present, but it hasn't turned up yet. It's a mug saying I was on the crew of Rahulastapa. That's brilliant. Rahulastapa. Only I did that one. Good. So it's lovely to be here. Finally, something's happened at the Edinburgh Fringe that Jerry Sadovitz has had his performance cancelled because he's too offensive. He was too offensive. It surprised me. And he maybe got his cock out. We don't know the full details, but if you're going to just cancel shows because someone's got their genitals out, there's going to be a lot of Edinburgh Fringe shows there that aren't happening. And if we're going to start cancelling shows just because people find them offensive, can we start with the Fawlty Towers dining experience, please? That should be the first one to go. We may talk about that. Jerry Sadovitz was actually one of the first acts I ever saw at the Edinburgh Fringe. And I think it's easy these days to take something out of context and go, that's very offensive, which you could do with every single thing that Jerry Sadovitz says. But it's, we probably don't have time to go into, but it's sort of, he's the victim of it. Right? I saw a Guardian journalist had written about Terry Gilliam doing rubbish stuff about black lesbians and, you know, I identify as buys a chair. And yeah, that's shit. And he's a massively wealthy man. Jerry Sadovitz is sort of the victim of all his own jokes. And he busts all taboos. So if he didn't do the racial ones, wouldn't that be racist for him? I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting thing. But I'm sad because, I mean, he lives that act. I mean, he's ruined his entire life doing that act. It's a very deep and clever and upsetting and unsettling, and don't go and see it if you are at all easily offended. And you can't because it's been cancelled, and that's the thing. I don't know. I just sort of think the Fringe, it shouldn't be about saying you're not allowed to do... They knew what they were getting into as well. So they're saying, the Pleasance is saying, we're all for freedom of speech and we support freedom of speech, but he's not. That doesn't go with our views, so he's not allowed... Which, that doesn't seem right. Not very funny, was it? But there we go. We'll talk to... We'll talk to... you know, but everyone finds different things offensive. I find someone copying all of John Cleese's work and not paying him for it offensive, even though he's John Cleese. So, you know, that's... Anyway, let's crack on. My guest, a fantastic final guest, a massive movie star. He's probably best known for playing Guru Such a Big Nubber in The Love Guru, which I believe there is a story behind, as well as being the brownest person to appear in Notting Hill, the film Notting Hill. Will you please welcome the amazing Ahmed Jalili, ladies and gentlemen. Here we come.
Come on in. Sit down.
Ahmed Jalili. He's a man who knows how to play a crowd. I can tell you that. Shameless man. I saw your show last night, and my favourite thing about your show is at the beginning you get the audience to give you a standing ovation at the start. Absolute genius.
I don't get standing ovations anymore. So why not do it? I was trying to parody those mediocre Netflix comedians who get a standing ovation.
Yeah.
But what I didn't flag up was the crap joke you open with. So when I open with a crap joke, I didn't say this is a crap joke. It just was a crap joke. I just thought that's really not very funny. So it was a shame.
Good. Is that mic working recently?
Maybe closer.
Tell us about... There is a story. I chose this credit, and then there is a story behind you being in The Love Guru and not really being in The Love Guru. Is that right?
I got cut out of the movie. apparently for being too funny. It's not a very good film, so I'm quite pleased they've cut me out. But I played Guru Satch a Big Nobber. Which required me to put two cucumbers into a nappy I was wearing. And all I had to do was to urinate into a pot, shake, and then pretend I'm celebrating something. So I did a Faustino Asprilla, kind of fist pump where the cucumbers went up as my hand went across. And it got such a big laugh. And then Sir Ben Kingsley came along and then he just did everything I did. And I said, what's he doing? Because he goes, he's totally stealing your shit. He's stealing your shit. I said, so you might as well just let him do it. He goes, yeah, we're going to let him do it. So you'll probably cut me out of the movie because we're going to cut you out of the movie. So yeah, but it worked out well because I'd anyone seen Love Guru? It's not a brilliant film. So
it's a great film, says second row, man in the second row.
Is it really?
No.
No, there you go. Thank you. Validation from
John Oliver's in it as well. I believe it was the credit I chose for John Oliver when he was on as well.
Exactly. So
there you go. I might be wrong. He was in one of those.
I met him then.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Notting Hill. I don't know if we ever talked about you being in Notting Hill.
Also, another film I was cut out of. Yeah. It was for being too brown. Notting Hill was a film where they try to show the diversity of the Notting Hill area. Then the American producer said, we want this to be more white. So they got rid of everyone. I had some lines that were taken out. So it looks like I'm an extra. I just give Hugh Grant the orange juice that then he spills over Julia Roberts. The only ethnic minority who stayed in the movie was Sanjeev Bhaskar. Right. So he had a couple of lines. But yeah, they whitewashed the film, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'm not bitter about it. I'm just saying that's just fact. You're all looking at me really shocked. But it's true. They did. They thought it wasn't white enough.
Yeah. Maybe we should cancel Notting Hill.
Yes.
Maybe we should. And while we're at it, pretty much all of the other ones as well. The Christmas one should definitely be cancelled. Love Actually. That's what it is.
Love Actually, yeah. Yes. Cancel the lot. White, racist, motherfuckers.
It's a problematic. Well, and he did one about, and I love Richard Curtis, but he did one about the DJs on the boats all having sex with underage girls and attempting to rape people. That one, you don't see that one so much. For some reason, that one's slightly mistimed. Look, your show is lovely to see you do stand-up. I came and saw you last night. Good times, and you're on tour with this all through the autumn as well. I noticed you go from Swansea, and then you play Melbourne, Sydney, Auckland, Brisbane, Perth, and then you're back at Herne Bay.
Yes. I have... People don't know... You'll know. He knows my manager. I have a manager called Nigel Klarfeld, who is partially sighted in the sense that he can only see you if you're like a foot away from the face. And so he'll often say, Omid, you got to get to this party. I'm with Idris Elba. And I said, Idris Elba from Luther? He goes, yeah. I said, what's he like? He'll text back saying, sorry, it was Moira Stewart. And when I get there, it's Diane Abbott. That's so he has no clue. So he blames the tour going everyone COVID, but actually he doesn't really see. So literally one night I'm in Swansea, then I'm up north in Aberdeen, then back in Exeter. I've actually racked up 38,000 miles, and we're driving ourselves as well. So yeah, it's
not
pretty
to Australia.
Bad.
You're not driving to Australia.
No, not to Australia. So. But that's just the way. Australia was booked before, and so I'm just fulfilling a contractual obligation that was booked in March, just when we went into lockdown, actually. So I've got to go back and fulfil that.
Yeah, so were you doing this tour before? Was the tour... You started the tour when lockdown came?
It was just about to start, and it's been put back and put back and put back. So, but it's great. You go out and you see audiences, and they're very... at the beginning, people really... You know, because we were told to stay home and watch Netflix, people's concept of comedy material, the expectation has gone up because the quality of material. So when you go out... I did one warm-up gag, and I thought it'd be fun to do COVID variant gags, which I thought was very, very relevant. I said, COVID variants, we've got the Delta variant, you know, we've got... You know, I had the bankers variant. It's pretty bad, but it cleared after 3 working days. And people were saying, this is shit! And I carried on, and I said, then I got the Alan Titchmarsh variant, which is like, once you've had it, you're suddenly very attractive to women of a certain age. And nobody got it because in Albania, no one had heard of Alan Titchmarsh. But I carried on. Then I said I had the Sean Bean variant. And people saying, this is shit. I said, no, wait for the Sean Bean variant. You know, it means any role I played, French, Turkish, Arab or English, even if I played an alien genetically spliced with the B, I still talk in a Yorkshire accent. And I heard this silence and someone at the back went, that's funny. Like that. And that was it. So that was like, I kept that in.
Well, it's a terrifically fun show, and I guess it does. I mean, it's not in any way similar to Jerry Sadovitz, except that you dance around a little bit with. There's still some, because you know your routines always have acknowledged your ethnicity, and from a starting point where it was, you know, maybe you were sort of forced to by the mores of the time to sort of ingratiate yourself and get the jokes in first, right? The joke, even though. You're not a Muslim, you would do jokes you'd do jokes about the Middle East and whatever.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, what I was trying to do, I reflect on the show of my, you know, 30 years of coming to the festival and how that's developed and how I had to ingratiate myself with white liberal kind of society. So even the first show was called I'm a Short, Fat Kebab Shop Owner's Son, because inside me there was a tall, thin, high-cheekboned English ponce screaming to get out. And I think that was my own kind of conflict, and I was trying to work through it through comedy. But now I think people just want to laugh, and what I've tried to do is try and explain white privilege in the same way after Black Lives Matter, a lot of black people were saying, look, we love white people. We're trying to explain how we're affected by this. You know, the song that won the Grammy, that amazing by the group Her, that said, when we say see us, you know, don't just try and say I've got a black friend, which kind of makes you look good in front of your white friends, see the oppression. So in a sense, what I've tried to do is try and tell white people what I've gone through, because actually when I worked with Whoopi Goldberg many years ago, she said to me, promise me you'll never stop doing stand-up, because for your people, you're like the Richard Pryor of brown people. I said, don't connect me with him. She goes, no, you're the first, so you've got to keep going, and then you'll inspire a whole bunch of... Which is what's happened. There's a whole bunch of Indians and Iranians, and there are about 5 Iranian comedians now. And she said, you just got to keep going. And that's why it seems inappropriate. We were talking about, we're both in our mid-50s still at the festival. We shouldn't really be here. But it kind of feels important. I will say this. I know it's a bit, it's serious, but I've, two friends of mine who are about the same age, they lost their son this year, their 22-year-old son, beautiful son, tragically lost his life. And that happened in May. And they decided to come to the festival specifically to find their funny bone again, to see if they're going to... And I took them to see Stuart Lee. I took them. I said, come and see Mark Thomas. They came and see, they saw my show. And they really thanked me. They left yesterday. They goes, it's the first time we've been able to laugh. And just when I was thinking, you know, I'm going to stop doing the festival because my humanity is caught up with my narcissism, you know. I can't keep pushing myself on social media. There's a point where you think, I just can't be a narcissist. But actually now I see the power of comedy and how just these two people who've lost their son have now feeling that we have to move on. We remember him. He's with us. But actually, to lose your sense of humor is that is when the slide happens. That's when you become old. That's when you become, and they're in their mid-50s, but they've still got their mojo. And because they were laughing their heads, and they never, I'd never seen them laugh so much. It was wonderful. So I see the power of it now.
And I think, you know, you're not an act where you're, you know, chastising people or bashing people over the head. I mean, if you are, it's in a funny way, but you're not bashing people over the head. But that audience you're talking to will, you know, that information is, it's very sort of subtly subversive, I think. And you're also making the points. But also you dance around it. You're able to do a few of the old jokes that you wouldn't do anymore by saying, I wouldn't do this joke anymore. And you're able to do a joke and accuse your audience of being racist for laughing at it.
So. It's very playful. But I think, look, at the end of the day, when you're looking at someone like Jerry Sadowitz, this is a tough one for us as comedians, because obviously as comedians, we believe in free speech. The whole point of the fringe is that we come here and you can see someone shoot a firework out of his asshole. And you'll pay money for that because that's the fringe, you know. And actually, when you look at some, there's a slight similarity between Stuart Lee, who you know very well, and Jerry Sadowitz in the sense that they're both kind of playing characters on stage. And Jerry Sadowitz is very, very open about, come and see my show. There's some amazing, amazing magic. And then you'll also see a screaming fascist. That's kind of, because that, even, I remember on 9/11, his first joke was, he goes, oh, the Twin Towers came down there, he goes, What should have happened, it was a domino effect that every single skyscraper went doom all the way to fucking LA, you bastards. And I thought, that's a bit harsh. He goes, I'm a screaming fascist. That's the whole point. So that's kind of what you get with Jerry. So I have to tell you, last night, and I'd said on Twitter, never check Twitter before you go to bed, because last week I checked it at 1:50 and I saw Olivia Newton-John passed away and I was really upset. So I said, never check Twitter. So I just thought, someone said, have you seen what's happened with Jerry? And I checked Twitter and it said that his show has been cancelled because he got his cock out. He called Rishi Sunak the P word and he blamed all economic problems on this government because it's run by blacks and women. And I just thought, I giggled myself to sleep. I said, that's Jerry. That's Jerry being arch. That's Jerry the character. That's Jerry the Sadowitz, the character. Because if he didn't do that character, that's what we pay to see. And by the way, he is the number one sleight of hand magician I've ever seen. So I know he's going to be rammed. He's going to tour and he'll say, I actually made my second show disappear in front of my fucking eyes, you know. So he'll take responsibility for it. But why we all disagree with what the Pleasants have done to him is because they know what they're getting with him. They know exactly what they're getting. So I'm hoping on behalf of the fringe, because a lot of people are struggling with numbers. I'm hoping it's a publicity stunt, because I put on Radio 4 and Jerry Sadowitz was the second story after Salman Rushdie. Yeah. So I think it's worked.
Well, if it is that, I don't know. That does seem weird. And I think, you know, he's holding up a mirror by being the worst thing possible. But he's the character, and possibly the man, you know, it's very hard to know, is so angry at the world and his own. He's at the bottom of the pit and he's shooting out at everything else. And yet all of his own barbs eventually come back onto him.
He's very damaged, but that's why we're here. We need the laughter of strangers to heal the wounds of our childhood, you know. My wounds are the size of Alaska and I need you. That's why I recognise him, and because he's a very wounded person, which is why he's kind of like a comedian's comedian. He makes us laugh.
Yeah. He is, yeah. So, you know, it's interesting stuff and it's great that we can talk about it. But, you know, equally, it's not like the Salman Rushdie thing, but you sort of can't go, oh, Salman Rushdie must be free to write any book about anything he wants, even if it offends people, and then say comedians can't do that because they're joking. You know, it's the same ballpark. anyway.
It's very strange.
Freedom of expression.
One of my first jokes, actually, when I was at the festival, was about Salman Rushdie. Because, you know, the fatwa was 33 years ago, in 1989. Ayatollah Khomeini, an Iranian kind of cleric, gave this ridiculous fatwa. And part of me thinks, wow, it's taken so long, because I've not heard of him being attacked at all. But because by 1995 there had been no attack, my first joke, I think I used to come out as an Arab, I said, the fatwa on Salman Rushdie has now been lifted. But on behalf of all Iranian dyslexics, we'd like to apologize for the death of Willy Rushton. Willy Rushton was an accident waiting to happen, ya Allah. You know. And I could make a joke about it because I didn't think anything would happen to him. But now that something's happened, and it's not looking good for him as well. I mean, he's in the hospital, and it's very shocking.
He's apparently talking and off the life support, so hopefully everything will be all right.
Thank God.
I mean, no, the comedian in me is thinking, you know, they're all talking about the money that you get for the fatwa. Do you get anything if you fail to kill? And, you know, and who's responsible? You imagine there's a little committee there going, well, sorry, no, you had to be dead. You can't have any of the money. But
the terrorists are saying, I'm the evil Knievel. I get paid for the attempt. That's a Dave Chappelle joke.
But, you know, there's comedy in everything, right? We'll find it eventually. So, look, I mean, I first really proper met you, and we were talking about this backstage in Adelaide.
Tell them.
It was something I tried to write a sitcom about, because it was a really unusual mixture of comedians, of Stu and me, and then
Adelaide Comedy Festival, 1997.
And it wasn't the real one. It had been set up by some rich guy, and it wasn't very well organised. But it was an incredible fun. We were all put in the same motel with a jacuzzi in it that we all sat in. But it was sort of a lot of quite insane comics.
There's about 16 of us, I think. Yeah. 16. So we all flew over, and they plied everyone with drinks. So as soon as we arrived in Australia, we're staying in a little motel. And I remember Parrot. There was a Scottish comic called Parrot who just jumped from the first floor. He jumped straight into the swimming pool. And there was a guy called Michael Smiley there. And there's a wonderful picture. I think it's online. I'm not sure if you can find it. It's probably been pixeled out. Where there's a jacuzzi with Stuart Lee and Richard Herring. You can't see me. We're all like... I kind of lean towards Stuart and Rich because they seem the most normal people. And literally, there's Smiley, who's a bald guy, looking at the camera. And Parrot has placed his bare testicles and penis over his head. And just with Stuart and Rich kind of looking disgusted. I remember thinking, I've got to stick around with these guys. They're the nice ones. But that was day one. And that was like the craziest festival of all time.
It was. It was. And we all, in the end, got on incredibly well. And David Jones was there. And he hired a clown. We went to Kangaroo Island. Did you come on that trip?
I didn't come on that. I heard about it.
And it was, you know, it was sort of insane. So I didn't think it would be a great... But, you know, equally, that kind of humour's never really appealed to me. The kind of cock on the shoulder sort of thing. Which always seems
cock, you know, on the
cock on the bald head.
It's,
but, you know,
so stupid. It was so childish. And also there was I was talking to Rich backstage. Do you remember there was an Australian act called Rash who had this Mohican, and he was always coming in and he was screaming at people and heckling during their shows. He was always drunk. And you never remember what happened the next day. So let's play a joke on Rash. Like, let's say he's offended us so much. Like, he's been divorced and he had to go at his ex-wife, so he came to that. And he, I'm really sorry, Ivor, I don't mean to say that. And with me, it was like that he tried to have anal sex with me. So I was walking like in a different... I never thought you'd follow through with it, Rash. I feel so awful. And he had no memory. He goes, I'm so sorry, mate. I mean, you're an attractive guy, but I'd never do that if I was like sober. I'm so sorry. It was a brilliant festival.
It was crazy.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
But you know, everyone was pretty near the big star. I mean, Michael Smiley's gone to be a very successful actor,
yeah.
And as have you. So you know, you were very quickly sort of being cast in these big movies. So yeah. How did that happen? How did you start getting the Hollywood films?
Well, it's interesting you say that because because you're a stand-up, we've got a bit more thick skin and there's a bit more kind of, we don't really care much. So I remember my agent said, there's a film called The Mummy. And we're going to fax. You've got to go to Soho now. Go to this shop, pick up the fax. 3 pages are going to come through. Learn your lines and go and do the audition. I went there and I saw there was one line on one page, another line. So I went there and I had these 3 lines. And I went there and there was this guy called Stephen Summers who goes, okay, let's. And then we so and so's going to read. Everyone read the part and I read my yalla, no, thank you. That's all I said. And they said, okay, let's do that again. But this time, and I said, sorry, you're giving me notes. They went, yeah. I said, oh, no, I've done these 3 non-lines as well as they can. And they said, well, what do you suggest? I said, why don't we put the script away? Let me just talk to the camera. And I said, the fatwa on Salman Rushdie has been lifted. But so I just started doing my act.
Yeah.
And they started laughing. And they gave me the role. And I actually told them, I said, listen, I told them straight. I said, look, I know this Hollywood, this is 1998, the film came out in 99. I know that you don't know how to write for Middle Eastern characters. What you've written is really offensive. I can't really say what you've written, but I know what you're going for. So will you let me improvise? So I remember living in Hounslow and the director saying, you just improvise. 9 times out of 10, I'll say, don't do it. But don't be like an actor feeling offended. Just don't do it and then try something else. And we'll take the credit anyway. So majority of that film is me messing around, and then they've kept bits in it. So right. Sometimes even when the camera wasn't, there's a couple of shots where they're shooting from far away, and they've kept in that film, which I didn't even know they were filming. Right. So it's in the movie, yeah.
And did you, you know, obviously you were getting cast, I think we talked about this years ago when we talked, but it's like the Nadim Sawala effect, is
yes.
That you can play any character from basically Mexico to India.
Yes.
There's a whole swathe of people you can play. And was there... You know, you were obviously in the early days. They were quite stereotypical.
All of them were.
Did you feel like it was important to do it anyway, or did you just think I'm getting work, or were you trying to affect change as you were?
Do you know, this is very interesting because I ended up doing a sitcom with Whoopi Goldberg,
yeah.
And then they said the same thing. Just play around with it. But they hadn't told the other actors. So when we're rehearsing, the guy playing Whoopi's brother just said, would you just say the fucking lines? And I said, sorry. And I said, I'm just playing. He goes, no, just say that you're an actor. Just say the goddamn lines. And then he got fired the next day. They fired him because I was the guy NBC had brought in for this role. And Whoopi Goldberg, when we did the series, every time we'd rehearse, and then they'd go back to writing stereotypical lines. And she actually said, because Ayatollah jokes, is that the best you've got? This guy's from Britain where he's won awards and, you got to do better. He's working his fucking ass off. Look what he's doing, and let's start writing proper things. So she actually had my back and was being very like, she knew, because she goes, I know what it's like. I'm a black person in America. You're 30 years, brown people are 30 years behind us. So I see what they're doing to you, what they did with black people.
Yeah.
So it needed people like that. It needed another race of people in show business to kind of protect me, and I've always been thankful to them.
Yeah, and it has, you know, over those decades, things have certainly, I mean, it's not over.
It's not perfect, but yeah.
but it's got a lot noticeably better.
A little bit better, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's up to us as well to stand up and be known and not shy away. That's why in my show... Actually, in my show at the very end, I do a routine that I did here at the Edinburgh Festival that got me cancelled. Now, that routine, my wife says, the reason you got cancelled is because it looked like slapping the ball. It looked like unprovoked violence towards a white person.
Yeah.
Whereas actually it was just a funny story that happened to be me, my dad and my uncle. But it was interesting, that story that got me, when I say cancelled, is like nobody, no agent wanted me because we saw you at the press launch and frankly, you should be ashamed of yourself. So it was important for me to do that routine because I knew, because funny is funny. And I felt it would be funny. But then when I did that, there was 300, 400 people just didn't laugh. So it's important for me to do that routine again.
Yeah.
Because I was talking to Eddie Izzard about this because we've both been doing comedy in different languages. And we're both, because I've been doing stuff in the Persian language, yeah. which is very interesting to do because you realize that funny is funny anywhere. You don't have to adapt. I mean, Eddie actually translates his stuff directly into French, directly into German. And I didn't translate everything, but you realize funny is funny and it doesn't matter where you are, when you are. Of course, context makes a big difference, mm-hmm. but that was the big thing. And I knew that story was funny. So to do it again 27 years later, after being cancelled, is a it just felt so cathartic for me. It was a very good thing to do. That's why yeah, I finished the show on it.
The guy who's being slapped is a kind of national front.
He's a national front, yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of weird. You would think even
you'd think
in the
with
90s
that context, yeah.
But
they didn't think it was funny.
Yeah. And there's within the show as well. You pay tribute to Sean Locke as well, yeah. which is a lovely moment. And
yeah, I think Sean. Are you all? Everyone knows Sean Locke. Sean Locke here. Round of applause for Sean Locke. Yeah. I just felt because Sean was the first person to believe in me and take me on tour with him until Avalon found out, because you're supposed to have an Avalon act open for you. So they said, this guy's been cancelled, but you can't have him. So I only did three gigs for him. And Sean was one of those people who was very, very, I would say very spiritually awake. He was always asking me, because I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i, which is a faith that grew out of Islam in the same way Christianity grew out of Judaism. So there's a connection, but it's an independent faith. So him and Bill Bailey were the only two people who always asked me about, tell us more about the Baha'i faith. And he'd always ask me, how are you? And he'd always talk about spiritual matters. And Sean was also a Chelsea fan like me. And whenever he saw me, I'll never forget, I was being attacked once verbally. Because do you remember there was a whole thing online about this guy, Count Dankula, because he'd done some Nazi pug dog thing. And I just refused to support him because that particular case, he kept telling the pug dog to say, you know, gas the Jews, which I didn't think was a necessary thing to say. So because you don't believe in free speech. So I was being attacked by these Chelsea fans and he just came out of nowhere, Sean. He went, oh, you lot, fuck off, leave him alone. And he pushed them out the way. He goes, what are you doing, Ahmed? Why are you even engaging with this? And he goes, I'd be on Twitter all day long. My wife won't let me. He goes, it's the whole Brexit thing. I'd be on Twitter the whole day long because he hated Brexit. He hated everything. And actually, he was one of the good guys. And we never really like laughed and joked. We just talked seriously with him, which is why when he died, I just suggested Chelsea Football Club do a minute's applause for him in the 58th minute, which was his age when he died. And his family came, and it was really wonderful to see that he was such a private person as well. And I think that's what I liked about him. There was something about him. He wasn't just one of the funniest comedians. He was also the most human and relatable and personable people. So I've always loved him as a person.
That's great. I didn't know him very well, and I met him a couple of times. And actually, when I'd gone through the thing where I'd been critical of a couple of comedians for just using disability as a punchline without really thinking about it. And just, as with all these things, I think you just need to think about why you're doing it and whether it's worth it, whether it's a good enough joke. But I had like 3 days where I got like, just basically called a spastic by Ricky Gervais fans on Twitter. And I tried to answer as many as possible. And he just texted me and said, you know, well done. You know, he was watching and that whole thing.
Yeah,
and he bothered to find my number and text me and say, well done for doing that. I thought that was good. Because I think he was a decent guy. You know, he was just a decent person and he didn't make a big play of it. It wasn't like, you know, he was interested in being funny on TV and that was what he was interested in.
And very private, actually. Yeah. And it was his family that told him don't go on Twitter because there was a Twitter account and he was all ready to send tweets about Brexit and everything. And they said, no, don't, because you're just going to get... exactly, pylons and all that, and, yeah. and he was aware of it.
Yeah.
But he doesn't realise, there's the odd time comedians have downtime. We sat out in our beds, we've got our hands down our pants, the other hand, we're just like tweeting with our right hand, because it passes the time, and you think you're sharpening up your comedy brain doing it, but actually you realise you do upset a lot of people. I upset a lot of people recently, and I didn't realise. It was other comedians, like I said, you really upset me as well.
Right.
And you realise it's not a place for political discussion. There's no place for nuance. Even, I just sent a tweet saying, Jerry Sadowitz, I giggled myself, and someone said, it's not clear, do you agree with his cancellation or not? And yeah. I said, look, either you have an ego problem and you're trying to get a reply, or you're just a flat-out idiot, you know. And then he got upset with me as well. And you do that because you've got a couple of, this will give me another 10 minutes of tweeting people. But it's never that serious, that's the thing. We never take it that seriously.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing, and it's impossible. I've been trying to engage with people a little bit today, and it's just you're not going to get anywhere in an argument this complex. Which involves understanding 30 years of comedy as well, to understand why some comedians will go, this is wrong.
Have some people been saying it's good that he's been cancelled?
I think it's always worth discussing. I think, you know, and it's always worth... And you know, I think there's... It's not like you're completely consistent and go, well, I always think this. I believe that someone said, what if Jim Davidson had said that and done this? And so it's a different... It's different because Jim Davidson hasn't done 30 years worth of clever, you know, and he's a high-status character and Jerry Sadowitz is a low-status character. But I wouldn't try and get Jim Davidson cancelled for doing it. I would just not. I think it's the same as anything. It's like it's your body, your choice. It's your brain. It's your choice what you laugh at. And I can say I don't think you should do that, but it's up to you to whether you want to find it
funny. Piers Morgan tried to cancel me live on television.
Really?
I was on to talk about the vaccine for trying to get more ethnic minorities to be tested, because a lot of brown and black people don't really, you know, trust being tested on. So there was like, with the vaccine that we got now, it was mostly white people were tested. So I was on to talk about to try and encourage people of colour to come on. But there was some hoo-ha about Little Britain blacking up or something. Yeah. Something that we know in comedy... You know, Matt Lucas and David Williams have dealt with it. They've said, look, we wouldn't do that now. And then they said, do you think it's right? Do you think it's... Piers Morgan said, do you think it's right to black up? Do you honestly think that's... And I said, well, those guys have apologised for it. You don't do that now. There was a over time. But we've seen you in your TV show. You put on white makeup and you played some middle-class woman. Do you think that's right? And he was really, like, angry and... And I just said, well, Piers, you know, when people have a go at black people, maybe there's a victim thing you're punching down, but I'm making fun of middle-class multitasking mothers in Chiswick who are an empowered group. So, yes, it's absolutely fine for me to do this. And he just went like, he just looked at me, and then Susanna Reid just said, now about the vaccine. And just quickly moved on, because they're just, people are always frothing at their mouth, because now they're looking for some kind of clip that goes viral so they can put it out and then more people watch Good Morning Britain. That's the way it works.
But people also want everything to just fit neatly into what, you know, what people who want a sense of things, it's like, this is great. I know you're not allowed to say this word, so if someone says this word, then that's it. They're racist and they're cancelled. Whereas you can say that, you know, but there are times you need to, you know, you can say the word. I did a whole show called Hitler Mustache, which again, I wouldn't do exactly as I did it then.
Brilliant show, by the way.
But I used yes. those words in the show, but to make some points about racism, and it was an anti-racism show, and an anti-BNP show. So, you know, there's subtlety to it, and there's, you know, you can't just say, you've said the P word, that's the end of it.
Well, do you know what it is? I have a 22-year-old son who said something really interesting to me. He goes, all this stuff that you see now, he goes, I think it's not just a millennial thing. I think because of all the crap that we've gone through, young people and people are just looking for sincerity, authenticity, and being real, because we can't tell. People are being so sarcastic. What do you mean by that? There's so much, things are just not clear for us. So sometimes, and he said to me, if you think Jerry Sadowitz should not have been cancelled, you have to say it. This is a disgrace. He should not have been cancelled, and the Pleasants are going to pay for this later on down the line. If you want to, that's what my generation, we want clarity. We want, you know, sincerity. You know, we don't want jokes when things like this happen. So that's the thing. Whereas we live in a world where you have to kind of, even when Stuart Lee says, you have to know everything about everything to understand my joke. A lot of people don't know. They're not informed. So we think we can do jokes about stuff people are not informed by. But actually, he goes, what people are looking for now is sincerity. And that's something that your generation, meaning people in their mid-50s, that's what you guys have missed. I don't know. Does anyone agree with that? Is that what people want?
Don't
people
know. Can't so be they're asked. All, they're all our
no
age.
No one gives a fuck.
They don't know. They don't know anything. A load of idiots. Mamma Mia! Mamma Mia! Cancel a lot of them. Mamma Mia, here we go again.
Yes! Do you know?
Tell me about that.
It was. I always believe that if you don't like ABBA, and I think I'd love to hear, I'm going to make a statement, and by round of applause, clap if you agree. If you don't like ABBA, you don't have a pulse.
There you go.
And I was very... still, but what a round of applause for that than anything you and I have said.
Should have got ABBA on.
Should have got ABBA on. But it was, I remember, I know Colin Firth because I did a benefit gig for his mother's school once. And he emailed me because, look, they think you're bringing you on. Will you do it? Please come along because it's just a fun, it's a bit of a laugh. And it's interesting with Colin Firth, he'd 10 years earlier, because we were filming at 2017, in 2007, he sent me an email out of the blue saying, "Dear Omid, I just thought you should know I had a dream about you and you were a lap dancer. I just thought you should know. Love, Colin." So I wrote back, "How funny, Colin, I had the same dream and your check bounced." And then he wrote back, "Because the lap dance was wholly unsatisfactory." So we go backwards and forwards. Then I met him on the film and we start talking. He's an Arsenal fan. I'm a Chelsea fan. We start talking and everything. And then... we didn't even mention this thing. And then when I got back home, I got another email saying, he goes, "Dear Romney, I've had another dream about you." At this time, you were wearing leathers. And it was all this kind of... But it was interesting that we never said anything. But he was absolutely right that it was just a fun... It was just a fun thing. And they very kindly gave me a post-credits bit. I don't know if people know about that. At the end of that film, there's a little post-credits they did with me because... You could just ask around on that film. And they showed a little bit that I was doing just to make my wife laugh. Because she said, "You don't sing in the film, you should sing." So I sang something and they kept it in. So, but it genuinely is. When I saw that film at the Hammersmith Apollo at the premiere, there were 3,600 people going absolutely nuts because Cher was in the crowd. Tom Hanks was behind us going, "Woo! Woo!" People were going, I've never seen a crowd go so bananas. And when they played Dancing Queen, the whole... 3,600 people singing and dancing to that. It was really quite something. And it seems to be universal. I've had really blokey people go, "Do you know what? I don't like those kind of films, but Mamma Mia, Mamma Mia 2, let's go around. That was fucking brilliant, that was. It really was. I loved, watched every minute of it. It was brilliant." So it seems to be universally loved, yes. I was very lucky.
Yeah. What about Sex and the City 2? Did you spot any of the tensions between the... main yes. cast that were to come up?
Yes, there were. There was a few tensions. I mean, they're all good friends, but the tension really was around Cynthia Nixon.
Right.
Because she had just become a lesbian. And I think that it shocked everybody. And I was just very open. The four of us were sat there and I just asked, I said, I'm not very good at, you know, building up a relationship. I said, "Why are you lesbian now?" Like that, just straight... Just straight, yeah. And she just said, "That's a really good question." I saw the others kind of leaning in. And she said, "It's because I'm married and I had a kid and I wanted another kid. And my husband said, if we have a second child, you're going to have to look after the child." And he was right. We had the second child and he didn't do anything. You know, he didn't. So I used to like cock. But I'm really into pussy right now. He goes, "I may go back to cock one day, but I'm happy with pussy right now." And it was just like, and everyone just like listened and that was it. And I realized they'd never really talked about it before. Sorry to use, I'm probably going to get canceled using those words now, but I'm just quoting what she said. And I think that was a big shock that she'd come out as a lesbian. And then she was, she's a politician now as well. Right. But I think they're very, very, one thing that shocked me was the woman who plays Samantha. You know, she's a... You can edit this. What's her name? What's her real name? Yeah, Kim Cattrall. Yeah, can you fix that? Because I know Kim Cattrall. Okay. I forgot her name.
We'll just make it so it goes seamlessly. Absolutely. I promise you we won't keep this thing.
was amazing about Kim Cattrall, my very good friend, was that she was so demure. And she was so, she plays this kind of sexual animal on the thing, but she's actually, when someone used it, afterwards she goes, Cynthia, I'm so sorry. She's saying cock and pussy in it. I said, what? She goes, I don't like that kind of language. And I was surprised that she's very demure. She goes, I'm not a prude, but I don't like that kind of language. And I was really shocked that she's, which made me realize what a brilliant actor she is, because she plays so opposite to the way she is. And they're great. I mean, there was a bit of tension between, I think, the director and them. Yeah. I made the director vomit, actually. It was amazing. I've never had that before. Where he, I don't know if you know Michael Patrick Kim, MPK is one of the great geniuses, but he's what you call one of those, he's uber flamboyant. I mean, he's one of those gay guys who like tries to make himself, he's got eyebrows that go up like at 45 degrees and everything is, he goes, Omid, you're wonderful. I'm so happy you're here. Everything you do is just so classy and I just love your work. And then when I came on set, he goes, right. He goes, Samantha's been caught having sex in Dubai. You're the hotel manager. I want you to come in. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Stir your coffee. And then he put his finger up, like, stir your coffee, hold it, and then say your line. Now, I thought he meant do that. So when we went to the scene, I stirred the coffee, and before I spoke, I went and put my finger up. And then I said, he goes, cut. He goes, what was the finger? Oh, my God. Talk about flagging up the comedy. Like, comedy, where are you? There it is. Yeah, that was fucking horrible. Yeah, can I get some water? Oh, Jesus Christ. Flagging up the... And they took him away, and he vomited. He goes, I've never vomited before. Oh, my God. He thinks he's a comedian flagging up the comedy. Jesus fucking Christ. This guy's a fucking asshole. Then I did the scene, and it finished. He goes, Omid, you're wonderful. I just love everything you do. He's kind of schizophrenic, this guy. He's hysterical. That was the only tension. I just made him vomit. I feel so bad about it.
Did you put your foot in it with the Queen?
No, hang on.
I mean, it's not really.
Now, hang on, that's really unfair.
You called her the wrong thing, didn't you?
This is the way the press spin things. I thought I played the Herald in the Queen's Platinum Jubilee thing, which is basically, I don't know if anyone watched it. It's basically the Windsor Horse Show, and what they wanted to do is make it like a Platinum Jubilee special for the Queen. So they had comedy, they had drama in it. Helen Mirren played Queen Elizabeth I. It was a gallop through the history of the monarchy. So, but the people coming were expecting the Windsor Horse Show. So we're doing this to no laughs. And they goes, Omid, you're going to have to do a warm-up. So I'm in a Herald's costume. Like, literally, I'm the only one wearing ruffs and these stupid clothes. And I had to go on to 4,500 people. I'm doing warm-ups. I said, well, the owner of the green Range Rover registration number LIZZY2. Can you please move your car? You're parked on top of Tom Cruise. And then you hear, what the hell? Are you making fun of me? Then I realized I was standing on top of Tom Cruise. So there are all these jokes that got them laughing. And here's the thing. The Queen had just blown off the state opening of Parliament. She didn't go to the state opening of Parliament, but she came to the Windsor Horse Show. So it was a very big moment. So in the end, I was saying goodbye to her, and I said, and thank you for choosing us over the state opening of Parliament. And it got a massive laugh, and she did that. She acknowledged the joke by doing that. And in the press the next day, there was an awkward moment, and they like to kind of like make out it was a bad moment. And all different newspapers, like, you know, like, to me, when the Queen does that, it means very funny, you're worth every penny, fat boy, you were brilliant. But the Daily Telegraph thought the hand up like that was like off with his head, you know, and they're making out like I'm a disgrace. And the Sun, they said that meant look at the tits on him, which I thought was really wrong. And they made out what was a great moment. They made it out like as if it was a real awkward moment.
Yeah.
But here's the story. Do you want to hear the story?
Yeah, that's
different, yeah. Okay, here's the story. This is what my wife told me not to tell this. We may cut this. This is just for you guys, and I don't know if it's appropriate. This is very, it's a true story. What I'm going to tell you is exactly word for word. Before we did the show with the Queen, we had four warm-up shows for the Royal Windsor Horse Show, and a different royal would come, and then there would be a little lineup with just me and Alan Titchmarsh together, and then we'd say hello. And the night before the Queen came, Princess Anne came. And so she's hugging Alan Titchmarsh. They all know Alan Titchmarsh and love him. And she looked at me. She goes, hello, Titchmarsh, how are you? All right? you know, still bagging bitches, are you? You know, there's all the, you know, they did like to be with us. It's really inappropriate. But she looked at me, Princess Anne, and goes, now you, I have a question for you. He goes, did you really volunteer to do this show? I said, why wouldn't I? Because, I mean, it's all stuff and nonsense. I would have thought horses and all this. I would have thought it's beneath you. And she looked really, like, upset. And it was a real moment, because I looked her in the eye. I said, Your Highness, it's been an honour of a lifetime. She went, I'm glad to hear it. You're exceptional. I'll go and tell the Queen. So when we did the show in front of the Queen apparently loved it. And then the organiser said, come here, we want to tell you something. They said, do you know, the Queen wasn't supposed to come. I said, why? He goes, she felt embarrassed that she'd blown off state opening of Parliament, didn't think it was right to come to a horse show. But Princess Anne had gone to her house after she saw you and said, oh, Mummy, you've got to come. They've got lots of acts you haven't seen. And do you know that Iranian comedian you like? He's humiliating himself in a herald's costume. You know, and he's begging not to be sent to Rwanda. And she went, yeah, all right. And that's why she came. It's because of me. I humiliated myself.
Let me ask you an emergency question, because I haven't done one for a couple of days. Let's see what...
I like emergency questions. Because, of course, that part of the story didn't really lead on to anything. It's just like...
No, it's good. I know people like them. Have you ever seen a ghost? Have I ever asked you if you've ever seen a ghost?
A ghost?
Yeah.
No, why? Is that an emergency question?
That's an emergency question, if you've ever seen a ghost. I'm glad you haven't. It's just a way of finding out if someone's mentally ill or not.
No.
You are mentally ill. If you were like a caterpillar, but you were you, and you could dissolve, you go into a chrysalis and you dissolve, but you can
dissolve,
come out,
out as something else.
You come out as anything else you want to come out of the chrysalis. What would you come out of the chrysalis as if you could choose anything to taint?
Alexis Sale.
Alexis Sale. What? So close in the end so far. You live in Ipswich now, is that right?
Yes, I live in Ipswich. Unbelievable.
I was sick on my own diarrhea in Ipswich. That's
were
all.
You? Yeah. You were sick on your own diarrhea.
Well, I had diarrhea and then I had to vomit and it was, I just had 4 hours of quite intense food poisoning.
But do you understand, you said I was sick on my own diarrhea. Yeah. I don't know if you got the, I thought he was eating his own diarrhea. I said, why wouldn't you be sick?
Usually it's delicious. I'd have diarrhea and then I didn't have time to flush the toilet and then I was sick on the diarrhea. Happened on the hour every hour for 4 hours and then my wife had to drive me home. We were going to go and see Sutton Hoo. It was my birthday. I think it was
Sutton
like
Hoo,
40th.
Yeah.
41st or 42nd birthday, and we had to drive home. So that's my feeling of Ipswich.
It's a great place, Ipswich. And, you know, if you're a football fan, Ipswich Town was always everyone's second football team in the 1970s and 80s because there were Terry Butcher, there were all these players. So I had just said a couple of things on Twitter that I like the film, not the film, I like Ipswich Town. And so they said, come down, and I went to the first few games. And in the first three games, the score was 2-2. First 2-2, 2-2, 2-2. So for the fourth game, I showed up in a 2-2. But the Ipswich fans didn't quite get the satire of what I was trying to do. And then I said, but the Wimbledon FC goalkeeper did proposition me, and I learned a very big important lesson that the Ipswich fans can be very rough, but goalkeepers can be very tender and complimentary. And I think I said this somewhere, and then Ipswich Town said, will you come and speak to the crowd at half time? So Ipswich is, they're in the League One, which is three divisions down from the Premier League, and they asked me to speak on a Tuesday night when they're playing Cheltenham Town, and there's still 21,000 people there. And I wanted to do a joke, and I ran it by a good friend of ours, Boothby Graffo. I said, look, I'm thinking of doing my Ipswich joke. And he goes, no, don't, for God's sake, they're going to hate that. Good luck with it. And I thought, I'll do it. So I came on. And he goes, we've got Omid Jalili here. And there was a cheer. I couldn't believe 21,000. There's nothing to do there. They don't go for a pie. They just sit in their seats. And he goes, why have you come to Ipswich? And I said, well, I came here to have a hip replacement and it went so well, I thought I'd stay. So I'm the only person who came to Ipswich for a hip switch.
Listen, there's some groans in there.
There's some groans in there.
There's some people,
but 21,000 people pissed themselves laughing. And it was great because it was 3 days after the Super Bowl. And I think the first thing I said, it's great that in America, the Super Bowl, they got Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, and Mary J. Blige. And you guys have got the bloke who had his knackers squeezed by Oliver Reed in Gladiator. So I think they've taken me into their heart, and I've been going to matches. I mean, I'm a Chelsea fan, but as I go there, on the odd days I go there, and it really is a lovely place, Ipswich. I can't recommend it highly enough.
I just feel, as a comedian, you know, it's a bit out there. If you're touring, Do you not? You can't get home very often.
You can. It's in the middle of the country, so actually, it's not bad. It's almost like instead of coming straight down, you go down and then off to the left when you come down from the north. So there's no different.
All right, then I'll accept it. I will. I'm going to allow.
Thank you.
Talking of football, you'll be very pleased to talk about this. I'm sure you you famously scored a penalty
against RoboKeeper.
Yeah.
Is that a cheer? Anyone? Give me one after three. Give me a cheer and a clap if you actually saw that. Okay, not enough. We need to talk about this shit. Okay. If you don't know, you talk about the RoboKeeper. Yeah. If you don't know, this is the greatest moment in my life. I've been playing football since I was 6 years old, playing for teams since I was 10. I was at the university at Northern Ireland. We played Irish B Division. Always thought I could play professionally, but I put on so much weight, I couldn't do it. So finally, just before the World Cup of 2014, the One Show brought me on to talk about my England football song that I'd made that it didn't do well because England was so crap at that World Cup. And they said for a bit, I remember Richard Madeley and Alex Jones, they goes, what we're going to do is just a bit of fun. We've got a robotic goalkeeper who no one's been able to score against. Lionel Messi, they showed us, had tried to score against it 16 times and couldn't do it. So they said, just have a go. And I said, what are you talking about? Because you're not going to score. We're going to show this robotic keeper. So just before we went on air, I said, is there any chance? The bloke said, we've left 2 inches. He goes, you're not going to score because the goalkeeper, it's robotic. It sees where your eyes and where you're shooting. So it actually moves before you've shot the ball. There's no way. But we've left 1 inch to one side and 1 inch there. If you get it in the top corner, you will score. But you have to be absolutely correct. I said, well, fuck it, I'll just go for it. So I shut my eyes, booted it, and it went in. And I went bananas. I did. I went home. I told my wife, I said, I've done something that Lionel Messi couldn't do. Because, excuse me, I don't know what that was, but you're running around a little children's playground scoring against some wooden goalkeeper. This is really inappropriate, you know. And people don't realise it is actually the greatest thing I think anyone ever has done. It really is. It's incredible. If you YouTube it, it should have got millions of hits, but because it was on a Vimeo clip, and I think John Bishop and Gary Lineker tweeted it straight away, and the Vimeo link crashed. So I put it out on a YouTube, and I said, please, guys, could you retweet it again? Needily, and they didn't. So it's only had like 70,000 hits or something, but it's it is the greatest moment of my life. But thank you for bringing it up.
That's all right.
And you can give me a round of applause for doing what Lionel Messi could not do. Thank you very much.
Is there any more of winning combination coming? I didn't see winning combination.
Winning combination was.
And I tried to understand it from it being written down.
I didn't even understand what the show was. It was a very confusing show. All I knew is if they won any money, I could do a winning combination joke. I said, you are a winning combination. A bit like Hitler, a bunker, and a cyanide pill. That's a winning combination. And of course, no one liked it except in care homes. We're number one in care homes. And people in care homes were like pissing themselves. I mean, anyway, but they liked that. They liked that joke. Come on. But it was a show that ran for two series. And I did it because, you know, as stand-up comedian, you know, me as a style of stand-up, I've always wanted to be, you know, I'm not your normal kind of chat to a crowd. I always feel with comedians who chat to a crowd, it means they haven't got an act. If you see all the big comics like Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, they haven't, Louis C.K., they've got an act. They don't mess around with crowd work. Crowd work's there if you're doing something, a club and something, someone smashes a glass, you can talk to the crowd. But I thought I'd do this because I'd never been an MC, so I thought you get to chat to the crowd. So my first time talking to someone in the crowd is what actually made ITV book the show. Because someone got through, and this is what happened. I said, hi there, congratulations, you're through. What's your name? She goes, my name's Janet. I said, what do you do, Janet? She goes, it's quite funny, I actually work for IKEA. I said, what's that? She goes, well, that's the funny thing. In England, we pronounce it IKEA, but in Sweden, they pronounce it IKEA. Did you know that? I said, no, how absolutely delightful. Do you know how it's really pronounced? She went, how? I said, nobody cares! And in the gallery, they jumped back. They said, give him a series now. We didn't even finish the pilot. It was good. They said, give him the series. That's the first time I started chatting to someone. Because I thought nobody cares. Nobody cares about that kind of chit chat. But now they actually would build in Omid talking, and everyone was so nervous. I'm going to scream at someone. So that's the thing. I'm not a game show host, but I have to tell you, having spoken to Tim Vine, a lot of our contemporaries do game shows. Yeah. But actually, because our generation of people turn our noses up a bit, because we used to think Bob Monkhouse. We thought you have to be a certain type of comedian, but actually, it's very difficult because you've got to talk to people, you've got to ask questions in the moment and not mess up, which is very, very difficult. You've got to keep lots of different comedy programs running in the back of your brain. Mm. And it's actually one of the most difficult and one of the most enjoyable things. So I'm very sad to say that there's going to be no more, but we did two series. And I've actually moved from 3 p.m. To 3 a.m. So you can see the show at 3 a.m. on ITV4.
I'll look at it. I think those things can be a curse. You know, if they're successful, I think it's nice for a bit, and then suddenly,
yes,
20 years later, you're still...
No, yeah. So I'm lucky. I'm lucky that I'm not doing it.
Two series is ideal. Yeah. That's absolutely fine. So, look, we're going to have to wrap it up. There's a lot more to talk to you about.
We'll that flew by, guys, didn't it? It flew by.
By our pants. So the your tour is called The Good Times.
The Good Times Tour, yes.
And it's UK...
Still, Australia. I'm going to Australia in September, but there's still dates until the last date is at the Shepherd's Bush Empire on the 2nd of December.
And is there more acting work in the pipeline?
Yes, I'm doing a great film where I have to lose weight for the first time. I put on weight for The Mummy and I never shifted the weight. So exactly 23 years later, I'm playing a Syrian refugee. And there was a part of me that was thinking, should I really be playing a Syrian? Because I'm an Iranian, because I owe David Baddiel, our friend, has been talking a lot about Jew face. And I said, well, if that's the case, every Jew I know should only play Jewish characters. And, you know, and Amber Heard should only play characters who shit the bed, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that I'm very happy to say I'm playing a Syrian refugee in a really great film, a Syrian refugee who's in Britain, who becomes a cultural hero. Okay. Where cultural people, you know, see him as a... Because he tries to save a bell. That's all I can tell you about. Okay. But it's really good.
I'm sure it would be fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up. The amazing Omid Jalili!
Thank you very much. They're cheering.
Thank you very much. They love you. Thank you very much.
I love you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to the Assembly Rooms for having us. We're back at the Leicester Square Theatre, September, October, November.
And well done, Richard Herring. It's his last one.
Thank you very much, everyone. Yay! I'm going on holiday!
You have been listening to Rahulastapa from the Edinburgh Fringe with me, Richard Herring, and my fantastic guest, who I know you know who it was. I'm not going to tell you again. You're not stupid. Thank you to Scamp Regard for playing this music. I'm indebted to my technician and friend, Reese Thomas. I'm also indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and to all the fantastic crew at the ballroom, at the Assembly Rooms, and everyone at the Assembly Rooms in Edinburgh. What a fantastic lot of people you are. Thanks for all your help. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time.
That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.